Hello, and welcome to another science fiction special edition podcast. I guess we didn't come up with a name for it, but this is just a bit of a free-for-all for science fiction television movies. And with us this evening is Eric. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
We have also Rob. And we have Lee.
No, I'm here, sorry. It's Rob.
No, you're not. No.
Or is it Lee? Am I Rob or am I Lee?
The world never knows.
Can I have my cue again?
And hi, Lee.
Hi.
That's better.
Hey, that sounds like Rob.
Hey.
Rob.
It's funny, I was just watching Full Metal Jacket again. And
you were?
That's a great thing to do.
makes me want to do the drill instructor on you.
Oh, no.
Bag of shit. You sound off when I call you.
It's so rare that I ever feel like watching that movie.
I mean, it's a fun movie. I'm not quite sure what the.
What is fun about it?
Yeah, I'm not sure that. You know, parts.
I don't know what to call it.
Yeah, maybe the second half it has a few fun parts, I guess. No, I haven't seen it in many years. One of those things I have to kind of get up to seeing, I guess. But Eric, how was it?
Oh, it was good. It's funny though because as I was watching it, I remember going and seeing it in the theater with you guys.
And how about Adam Baldwin?
Yeah,
you know, much younger Adam Baldwin.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I was watching him in that, I kept thinking of Jane and Firefly, which
exactly.
Is almost certainly one of the TV shows we'll talk about.
I think that's when Adam Baldwin, was at the height of his powers.
Oh, you think so?
Yeah, I think that was his piece de resistance.
You mean back when he played Animal Mother?
Yes.
You know, Full Metal Jacket is actually not science fiction.
No,
it's not.
Wait a minute.
I'm sorry to throw a wrench in this already.
So we're going to cover two main topics with, I'm sure, lots of offshoots and tangents and everything else. But the first topic we wanted to come up with tonight is, which I think I'll start with, I think it's maybe, hopefully, a little bit easier to explain. What is it about science fiction that is so compelling? Why do we find it so fascinating? And whatever that is, why can't more movies and television shows capture whatever that happens to be? And Eric, I'm going to let you maybe, you know, see what you get.
Well, as we've been doing the Star Trek podcasts, this question has come up, or at least in my mind, a number of times. And the conclusion that I've come to is that it has to do with curiosity. And it's interesting because when you look at animal life on Earth, virtually every animal you can think of, birds, fish, mammals, lizards, reptiles, they all seem to share a sense of curiosity for whatever reason. I'm sure that there are academics who have studied that, but I find that interesting that maybe the most common thread among animal life on Earth, including humans, of course, is curiosity. I think that's the fundamental thing that inspires that sense of wonder that humans crave, probably because of their innate curiosity. We like to be presented with a mystery. We like to be amazed. We like to have a sense of things bigger and more magnificent and mysterious than we are and that we can understand. And science fiction is maybe the ideal medium to provide that sense of wonder, to evoke that sense of wonder.
Oh, that's good, Eric. I think you got a good point there. And so, to follow that up with our original question here, is assuming you believe that our modern mass media is not capturing this essence of it, Why is it such a problem for them?
I think part of it is that most of our entertainment, maybe science fiction most notably, has been dumbed down by the corporatization of most media, of television shows, networks, things like that. And along with that, I think the networks have always underestimated the audiences. They think we're all a bunch of morons, and at the lowest common denominator, we are. But, you know, Gene Roddenberry talked about this a number of times, about the, you know, the ridicule that Trek fans have always gotten, and that he thought it was unfair because, you know, science fiction fandom goes way, way beyond the geeky boys who, you know, dress up in costumes and have no hope of ever getting laid. I think that
that's fundamentally what the
well,
reason
and
is.
I think also that there are very few legitimate science fiction writers producing science fiction movies and TV these days. So the writers who know how to produce decent science fiction aren't the ones producing the TV shows and movies, by and large. That's, I mean, there are exceptions, of course.
Okay, thanks, Eric. Rob, do you want to jump in with your answer here? What is it about science fiction that you find compelling?
Well, let me just focus on one aspect of it that I have always found compelling, and others find my obsession with it somewhat irritating at times, which is science fiction as a means of dealing with social problems or conflicts of ideas in a safe space, if you will. No pun intended, or pun intended, or whatever. that we can say things about what's happening to us more forthrightly, ironically, if we place it sometime in the future or sometime in the past. I mean, in some ways, historical fiction or drama can serve a similar purpose, but science fiction is another way of addressing these issues or burning questions of the day. And a couple of the major themes in Star Trek that I notice keep coming up are, first of all, how to deal with, from the perspective of Americans, how do we deal with the ideological challenge presented by communism in the battle for the hearts and minds of the rest of the planet? We see that playing out and taking different forms in Star Trek, and we've talked about it, so I won't go into it here, but, you know, lots of the ways in which it comes up are through, you know, machines having control over society in some way, in some respect. Another major theme that I think really is quite common in Star Trek is, how do we deal with the counterculture? I mean, these are 1960s concerns, right? How do we deal with the counterculture? In other words, how do we synthesize what's best of the counterculture and the establishment culture? And Star Trek is, in one sense, an attempt to do that, right? It's an attempt to, it offers a quasi-military or military setting in which men and women serve together, in which there is a much more casual relationship between, I should say a much more casual command structure, and in which, you know, the rules are not followed as often as they would be in a traditional military setting. Anyway, but I think those are some themes that come up, and it's a way of dealing with it in that if you dealt with the same problem and set it in, you know, contemporary present day without any, you know, fantasy or sci-fi elements, it would be much more difficult to address those problems. You'd be accused of being ideological. You'd have to strain to find balance. You'd be constantly weighed down by trying to be accurate. But you're free of all those worries when you set it in the galaxy far, far away. So I'll leave it at, I think I have a tendency to ramble on in these things, so I'm going to stop there.
Well, thank you, Rob. That's very considerate.
One thing that I'd like to point out is, Rob, you were referring, or apparently based your comments entirely on Star Trek, and that's cool, but I wanted to open this up to the entire spectrum of science fiction TV shows and movies.
Yeah, and I should add that I do think this is a universal, no pun intended, asset of science fiction in general, is that it's able, and you can see that another a good example is the more recent Battlestar Galactica. But anyway, I yield the floor.
Thank you, Rob. Lee, would you like to jump in and tell us what you think of science fiction, the concept of it?
Sure. I guess the angle that I'm going to take is that when I really think about science fiction and what, you know, the stories are about, what they consist of, and kind of the arcs of the stories, that basically it's the same story that's been told for thousands of years. You know, the Odyssey and the Iliad, for instance. You know, Star Trek and all these other stories are often, you know, updates of that. You often have, you know, the hero, who's often a captain or a leader of men, and they go on a journey, or they have a mission, they go to new lands, they encounter monsters and gods, they often have extraordinary powers, extraordinary weapons, and we can see that in science fiction, you know, these different elements of, you know, instead of the ocean, it's space, and instead of another land, it's another planet, and instead of gods and monsters, there's aliens who are either godlike or monstery. And it's just interesting also how, you know, there's other parallels also, you know, like, you know, in the ancient myths and stories, very often the hero meets hot women and encounters mysteries and suffering and faces questions of good and evil and right and wrong and has opportunities even at times for transcendence, for experiencing something larger than the, you know, the normal world, the world that they've left behind in their home, you know, on their home planet or their home village or their home territory, their home city. And also just an interesting interest in transformations, like things turning into other things and creatures not being what they appear to be. That this is a huge theme in, like, you know, I guess I'm thinking mostly about Greek myth just because that's what I know the most about. But there's so many parallels between that and science fiction. And I didn't, like, come up with a representative list or anything, but, you know, I think you could just about go on all day about this. So I think, in other words, just to sum up, that our fascination with these stories is that they are basically an updated version of the same stories that we've been telling ourselves and each other probably since the beginning. You know, the difference is that we've updated it to reflect our own time and condition. Our own time and condition is primarily defined in many respects by technology and by this rapid social and economic and technological and military change. So, you know, science fiction is contemporary mythology.
Thanks, Lee. I'll just throw mine out there really quick, and I think you all have some really interesting points about that. And what a lot of it comes down on my end is it's really, of course, it's a way to express, you know, possibly familiar or not familiar ideas in fiction. It's also another way of expressing, you know, our fear of the unknown, that kind of thing. You know, it's also, I look at science fiction, at least being attractive to me, is a way of, you know, kind of dreaming, if you know what I mean. It's you know, imagining things that are really kind of outside of something in our everyday lives, you know, things like faster than light speed and alien worlds and all that stuff. That's something that's very, very compelling, I believe, that really... makes it interesting, even if it's something that, you know, you can scoff at and everything else. I think it's just that imaginative way of looking at things, and it's attractive from many angles, of course. And it's really, as far as getting into a little bit of why they don't capture it, I think really what it comes down to is that often science fiction, like other genres, is just used as kind of a blunt instrument, really. You know, Westerns in space or other kinds of thing that I'm not sure you can really count as being science fiction. I'm sure we'll get into that later. But so that's kind of my short answer about that. Lee, go ahead, and maybe we'll just stay on that topic and go ahead and what's the problem, actually? What Eric mentioned, that he believes that it's being deliberately dumbed down by networks or corporations, and that, you know, right or not, they're the ones doing it, and that the audience can't handle the truth, so to speak. So what's your take on it?
Well, I think there's a lot to that, but I think I'm going to talk about something, kind of take a different angle on it, that I think one of the root causes is basically a widespread disinterest in ideas. You know, ideas relating to human destiny and human nature and the nature of, you know, consciousness and the nature of the world, you know, external reality, you know, how we relate and how we don't relate to each other, you know, some of the things that Rob was alluding to, that people are just not terribly interested in these things. They're not well-versed in the questions. They don't look for them. They don't often know them when they're experiencing them. And, you know, one of the big ideas, actually, I think, that is really missing, for me, we were talking, you know, when we were originally talking about this, we were thinking about, well, the distinctions between, like, hard sci-fi and, you know, soft sci-fi. And I was thinking that one of the major signs, for me anyway, of like hard, by which I mean to me serious science fiction, is a very kind of profound sense or feeling of presence of time and space. And now when I say time and space in the context of science fiction, you know, I think the thing that pops into people's minds is, like, you know, time travel and, you know, some sort of like freaky spatial anomalies and stuff like that. But what I'm talking about is the absolutely mind-pummeling, mind-overwhelming reality of the vastness of time and space as uncovered by modern science. And by modern, I mean, you know, going back several hundred years, the universe just keeps getting bigger and older. And, you know, so I think, like, a really good, strong science fiction, hard science fiction story or film will have this very strong sense of presence of time and space. And, you know, this is an example of that. I would say, you know, 2001. I mean, it actually starts millions of years in the past. And you know, when they go to Jupiter, it takes a long time, and you feel that it takes a long time. You know, contemporary science fiction, people don't have the patience for this stuff.
Well, Lee,
they want everything to happen, you know.
Lee, I think that we can all agree that 2001 is probably the gold standard for what we're terming hard science
fiction.
Hold
on there, dude. Hold on. we'll get into this a little bit later, but as I've said before, I have some issues with 2001. But
and just to finish up, and then the other I guess, major point I would make is that, that not only a disinterest in ideas, but this overly developed interest in, you know, spectacle and action, and you know, that, that ideas and space and time are, you know, context and excuses to blow things up and for people to fight. And to have, you know, weird aliens and freaky visuals, and that unfortunately these are the things that people respond most readily to, and that, you know, executives and movie companies and writers know, unfortunately, is going to have a better chance of success.
I would tend to agree with that, Lee. Actually, what you were, some of what you were talking about, you know, the sense of time and space, that goes back to what I was talking about with the sense of wonder, the, you know, the mystery, the vastness of it that I think is so appealing about science fiction.
Yeah, and also the question, right, of what's out there.
Yeah. The mystery, you know, and, not knowing.
You know, with a lot of this content, with most science fiction, at least that I see on television and movies, that is a very, that's very low on the list of things that those shows are interested in.
Yep.
You know, that the most freaky, amazing things happen and people are like, oh, wow. Anyway, let's go blow some stuff up, or I have to work on my relationship with my daughter. Not
right.
That those aren't also good things.
Seems like quite disconnect there, though, isn't it?
Well, I wonder how much of this, what we perceive as the poverty in science fiction, is has to do with an unwillingness to re-examine some of the tropes and to go where no one has gone before. I'm just going to talk in science fiction platitudes throughout
the podcast. As you attack them, you shall use them.
I shall use them, exactly.
Isn't that like jiu-jitsu or something?
Exactly. You know, I mean, what, to go back to Star Trek again, I mean, one of the there was an op-ed by Ron Moore, the developer of the more recent Battlestar Galactica, about the constraints that the writers were put under in the latter Star Trek series, about conflicts between characters, and how they were confined by what had been done before in the Star Trek universe, and Battlestar Galactica, I see, is Ron Moore's attempt to do what he wanted to do with Star Trek but couldn't. What Star Trek Voyager, or I'm sorry, Star Trek Enterprise should have been, but couldn't be because of, they're too wedded to things that they'd already done. Aliens with wrinkled foreheads, with bumps on their foreheads.
Right.
And so I say, I mean, in one sense, we're living in the golden age of science fiction, television, and movies, because I suspect that there are more sci-fi movies coming out now than at any time before. I could be wrong. In fact, I probably am wrong, but I'm going to say it anyway.
there you go, Rob.
And you know, there are plenty of science fiction TV shows. You know, to turn on the Sci-Fi Channel or Sci-Fi, as it's now called.
Yeah, lame.
See, but what has always struck me, and the reason why I didn't get into any of the series except for Battlestar Galactica, is I didn't perceive anything new. But it could be that they haven't found a way to express that wonder at the vastness of space and time in a new way, in a way that's going to get our attention. So this could be, you know, a different way of saying what Lee's been saying. I also wonder if there's another way to synthesize what we've all been saying, is that science fiction serves as the new myth because religion has, in many respects, lost its potency. The myths about gods and heroes with extraordinary abilities no longer ring true, for the most part.
It's interesting that you should mention that, Rob, because one of the things I was going to point out when I was talking about that whole sense of wonder thing is that the curiosity and the sense of wonder is what draws people to religion as well.
Yeah, that's no accident. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that one of the reasons that science fiction draws such devoted fans and adherents is because, you know, it in the absence of religion, it provides that, it fills that hole, it provides that need that people have innately.
Yeah, I would second that.
You would second that, that's good. Yeah. If anyone actually listened to these podcasts, maybe we would get some hardcore Stargate SG fan would speak up.
Oh, you definitely would, or a Babylon 5 or some other...
Babylon 5, one of those shows. But those shows...
Two shows I have pretty much zero familiarity with.
I have a little bit of familiarity with them, but not... What do you mean by that?
Oh, nothing, Eric.
Yes, I know, I'm a geek.
No, I was just saying that then they could potentially...
point something out.
Educate us on how these shows are groundbreaking.
From what I have seen of both Stargate and Babylon 5, they're not bad shows. I mean, they obviously some thought went into both the writing and the production, particularly Babylon 5. I mean, you had Harlan Ellison writing for it, who is, you know, a very well-known writer, very controversial, but very well-known. But it was, I think, just as you, Rob, and Lee have both talked about, it was more of the same, just dressed differently. You know, it was basically action-adventure set in space. And there was, I guess, in Babylon 5, there was an element of, you know, their whole war was based on something, it had to do with, as I recall, the nature of, well, not the universe, but which supremely powerful alien force was going to be ascendant, which of their forces was going to be ascendant, and, you know, the destiny of the development of life in the universe and things like that, which is, you know, those are very big themes, and, you know, it evokes that time and space sense that you were talking about, Lee. But, you know, on another level, it was, you know, basically Star Trek or Star Wars in, like I said, wearing different clothes.
Yeah, in fact, I saw most of them when they were coming out, I think. And I mean, I really liked the show. I don't need to see it again. But I think it almost seems like it was a conscious effort to combine Star Trek and Star Wars, actually, now that I think about it. And there were some really good things about it. You know, I thought they worked hard to develop, you know, the different cultures of these different alien groups.
Mm-hmm.
So that was positive. You know, they weren't just given a funny forehead and a couple of social characteristics and then just leave it at that.
Well,
a weird
accent.
So that was nice.
And with Babylon 5, although I didn't see all of them, I saw a fair number of them, and enough to get a sense of the overall series arc. And now that I think of it, that series probably was anomalous in that it actually did have a coherent, not only story arc, but series arc that you could follow. It appeared that the producers actually sat down and thought about, okay, where do we want to start, where do we want to end, and how are we going to get there? And, you know, actually followed that plan to develop it, because that's fairly unusual.
Yeah, I mean, the guy in charge of it, I forget his name. I mean, he's one of these, like... Yeah, he's like one of these, you know, the guy that did Firefly. He's one of those guys who just has all these ideas and this kind of vision for a story. You know, a couple downsides to the... Sorry you guys haven't... Talking about something you haven't seen, John and Rob, but just one couple quick downsides to the series maybe was, you know, it was in the 90s and it had these kind of cheesy computer... generated effects, which were not always successful.
I do remember that part, actually, when I saw
it. And also, you know, it takes place in the space station, so they don't actually go anywhere a lot of the time.
Which was the original complaint with DS9, actually, too, I remember.
Yeah, yeah. So that, and they, you know, and they find, I'm sure, and same, they do exactly the same thing that I suppose they did with DS9. I mean, they eventually get a ship, and they start flying around, so they still, the station is still there.
Eric, do you think that DS9, since it was... around the same time period when they were both on the air, I think, that it, you know, that maybe the way the more open and this the way that it was less based on some kind of canon like Star Trek is, kind of encouraged the people who were doing DS9 to open things up the way they did the last few seasons?
Well, I think, one thing we have to remember is Ron Moore was one of the executive producers and creators of DS9.
Right, right.
And he, what Rob was talking about, the restrictions that they had placed on them, particularly in Next Gen, were put there by Gene Roddenberry because he envisioned 23rd or 24th century people, particularly those in Starfleet, as not as being better, not having the interpersonal conflicts and such as that that we do today, which, I mean, there's lots of room for debate there, personally. I think it's ridiculous, and when you want to write drama, it basically is hobbling the writers, too. But, yeah, to answer your question, Moore definitely, from what I understand, definitely wanted to get away from that. And the way he did that was putting it on not a Starfleet space station, but, you know, it was an ex-Cardassian space station in orbit around Bajor.
Right, right. I think the other thing that is interesting, though, is how the show, if you watch the first couple of seasons or so, it's fairly episodic, a lot like Next Gen was at the time, or late Next Gen, which makes sense, of course, a lot of the same people. But it grew into a serial, you know, big story arc type of system with a lot of bigger things that definitely were not like Next Gen.
I think that just, I don't know for sure. I think it.
Yeah, I'm totally speculating.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I noticed that too, because I think it was the third season when they brought Worf on, and that's when things really started to change. You know, you had the conflict, you started off with the conflict with the Klingons, and then they moved on to the big war with the Dominion War, which was huge. And, that had to have been intentional. Whether or not it was in response to what was happening with Babylon 5, given the fact that, I mean, that would make sense. They were on at the same time. They were both about science fiction shows, about space stations, with big conflicts going on. So, yeah, I could see that as, you know, being the competition between the two shows, as well as just an evolution of the show itself.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
So why is 2001 the gold standard?
Well, I'll give you my quick answer, and I mean, some of it's quite obvious. Is it's one of the few times, as Lee pointed out, that the time and space element are, or at least they attempt to address that there. You know, the realities of man living in space are great, put in great detail. There's the usual things that are pointed out, such as the fact that there's no sound in space, you know, that kind of business, and all that stuff. Those are the nuts and bolts, basically, that I think one of the few times where they got it right, or as close to right as they could.
Yeah, you know, regarding the sound, sorry to interrupt, but I just want to make this joke that regarding sound in space in 2001, no one can hear you yawn in space.
And actually, the one, and of course the one thing you can hear during those space scenes when the guys are on their suits is their breathing.
Can you hear their heartbeats too?
I don't think you hear the heartbeats.
Okay,
but
you know what I like about that, John, is that it, you know, space is a very nasty place.
Yeah.
And, you know, with most shows, you don't get that sense at all. They may as well just be sailing along in a, you know, on a pond somewhere. But with 2001, with that breathing, you get this sense of, you know, this fragile bit of human flesh and consciousness.
Yep.
There's just a wafer-thin barrier between it and this utterly heartless, almost heatless, airless,
right, and I think
environment that's going to destroy you without a second, without even a first thought.
Yeah, and the other, beyond that aspect of it, of course, though, the way that it attempts to deal with the idea of alien intelligence, you know, you don't meet again. There's no, and even at the time, you know, they were still doing conventional, you know, like big robots or guys with funny hats and things like that, and suits. Were
giant heads.
Yeah, they were the alien look, and you didn't really... I mean, this was something that was, for the most part, incomprehensible to humans. That's another part of the science fiction element that is, I think, amazing for that film.
Yeah, you know that in a lot of other science fiction TV and movies, you know you're faced with a superior intelligence because it talks like this. Like Don Mordo, apparently. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's got an impressive, with a lot of reverb on it, or something like that.
Yeah, it has a very impressive voice modulation and a deep kind of rumbling sound, and it can seize the ship.
Yeah, of course.
And you're like, oh, wow.
Preferably with a giant hand.
They are smart, yeah. Yeah, as you guys recently encountered with the groping hand.
All right, to play devil's advocate for a moment regarding 2001... What about the ending, though? The ending seems like, in one sense, a cop-out, because the creators were unwilling to describe in the same naturalistic terms that they had depicted everything else in the film. They were unable or unwilling to describe the aliens and the experience that, you know, the astronaut encounters at the end when he's, you know, when he goes into the giant monolith. And isn't that really just the same as a well-modulated voice, a lot of psychedelic effects? And...
You know, Rob, in one sense, I'm in complete agreement with you, and if we had done this, say, 6 months ago, I would have been right on board with that take. But I was thinking about it, and it's been a while since I've seen the movie. I really should rewatch it, but it's interesting because you could actually divide it into three segments. The first one is with the Australopithecines, you know, 2.5 million years ago or 3 million years ago, whatever it was. And we see that and we understand completely what's going on. We understand things about the environment and the nature of life and living and survival that these Australopithecines are completely oblivious of because of, you know, they hadn't evolved enough. And, of course, the monolith is introduced, and it's something that we don't understand, but they understand it even less than we do. And the monolith is sort of the common thread that runs throughout the entire movie. And then we jump ahead to 1999, I think it is, when they discover the monolith on the moon. And, you know, this is not... I mean, it came out in 68, was it?
Yes.
So, I mean, it was definitely in the future, but it was still recognizable to us. I mean, the people were understandable. They're like us. You know, the environment is not that much further in the future. And, of course, then we go, you know, you jump to the discovering the trip to Jupiter. And so, you know, we're basically understanding most of this. It's familiar to us, if a little disconcerting and confusing in places.
Of course, go ahead.
And then the capstone, the final act, is totally incomprehensible to us, much as if we are now the Australopithecines in this environment that we have, that we don't understand, and experiencing things that are completely incomprehensible. So there's an artistic unity to it that I think is compelling. And it used to really annoy me because I actually saw the movie before I read the book. And when I first saw the movie, and I actually saw it a couple of times before I read the book, I never understood what the hell was going on at the end, what Dave was experiencing and all of that. And it irritated the hell out of me because I never understood that until I read the book. And then I read the book and it made perfect sense.
Well, what does the book say?
Well, the book says that Dave actually entered the monolith and it was providing a portal or a tunnel or whatever you want to call it to a new location where the alien intelligence adapted him, spurred his evolution, just like
they did the Australopithecines 3.5 million years ago, or however long ago it was. It was just, they were doing the same, just like they spurred the evolution of the Australopithecines so that they could develop into us. Now they're taking us and spurring our evolution into whatever comes next.
See, I'm kind of glad that didn't make it into the movie, because by not explaining it before, it just opens up so many sort of possibilities for, you know, metaphorical interpretations, and, you know, it makes me look back at the rest of the movie and then think, well, you know, symbolically, what can all this be about?
Well, and there's that, and also it occurred to me that, you know, ultimately, even if you don't understand what is happening to Dave, even if you don't understand that he has entered the monolith and that the aliens are using it as a portal to bring him somewhere else to tinker with his DNA and his evolution, even if you don't understand all that, the end makes it clear that whatever has happened, however it has happened, there is a new form of life. And that is the ultimate point of the movie and the story. So, whereas, you know, before I didn't think it succeeded that way, now I guess I'm more of the opinion that it actually does.
Yeah, and if you think back, like what I was saying about the mythological aspect, is if you think of like 2001 as a myth, what happens at the end? I mean, it's apotheosis. He becomes a god.
No, I wouldn't agree with that.
This is the whole point when we're talking about the like with 2001 that why I just find it so interesting is it is so suggestive and also so inscrutable. There's not like it's open to endless interpretation.
Right, it's like great.
But what I'm saying is that with the basic, you know, mythological story, is, you know, he is basically at the end, he's taken up.
Right.
And he's reborn as this new, probably super being, not as God, capital G, but as
something new.
We would consider, you know, we wouldn't be able to tell the difference if we met him. Probably between, you know, new baby Dave Godling, and the actual God, you know, I don't think it takes that much to really impress us.
Yeah. Just like Apollo.
But yeah, and
hopefully
and
better
said,
than that.
I think, and this is Rob. This also, I guess, I would say, an answer to what your complaint is that. You know, to try to put it in expressible, comprehensible terms, you know, if Kubrick had done that, he would have lost that whole dimension. That there's this idea that there is this dimension of existence or consciousness that is actually beyond what we can understand right now. So he can only imply it and kind of leave us to ponder and imagine what that might actually be or what that might actually be like. If we too went through the, you know, the 30-minute psychedelic vagina to be reborn, and also, you know, another thing that in the movie, I mean, who knows where the monolith came from? You know, maybe God did put it there.
You could certainly read it that way, couldn't you?
You know, there's nothing. I don't think there's anything. You know, I guess the natural assumption is that it's aliens, of course, but you know, and we also assume that they're still that these aliens still even exist. Maybe the monolith is gone. It's an independent sort of force now that is doing this automatically. And there's all sorts of things to.
Well, I think that's that comes down to the point where, if you look at the history of the way this film was made, it originally had a lot of subtitles put or intertitles in with certain scenes, explaining a lot of this stuff, and at. You know, during the post-production process, Kubrick decided to remove almost everything that explained a lot of this stuff, or at least some of it.
Was that specifically so that the audience would be forced to make their own interpretations about what was going on?
I have to assume that. I mean, he was notoriously bad about explaining his films, really. He didn't like to do that, and in fact, a couple of the titles that are in there were kind of put in grudgingly, I think. Originally, I don't think he wanted any titles at all. So,
well, you know, actually, that's one thing that I really admire about Kubrick, because typically audiences are spoon-fed way, way, way too much. And, you know, not spoon-feeding and not pulling any of his punches, I think that's what sets him apart from the vast majority, well, sets him apart and above most directors.
Yeah, it's certainly the minority of them that are willing and actually able to do that within the confines of a, you know, Hollywood studio system or, right, you know, corporate structure we've been talking about.
I don't think that would be possible today. I was just going to say.
Very few could do it. I mean,
who do you think could, John? I'm just curious.
You know, if somebody like Steven Spielberg, if he actually wanted to, could probably get away with it.
He had a chance to with AI, though, didn't he?
Yeah, I'm not saying he would do it. I'm just saying he could.
Yes.
I think if he wanted to put out a film of that nature, he would get funding for it and it would get made. That's all I'm saying. I don't expect him to do it.
And you know, it's interesting you should mention AI, because he did both AI, which was a former Kubrick production,
right,
and Minority Report, which was from a Philip K. Dick story.
Yep, exactly.
And in both cases, he wimped out. He could have turned both of those into remarkable, meaningful, very profound movies, and particularly at the very end, he completely caved to, I don't know whether it was studio pressure or some sense of what would be acceptable to the audience or the mass audience, but I was really, really disappointed in both of them.
Well, Eric, what do you think was the problem with the Minority Report, which I actually really liked? I'm not saying he doesn't have problems, but I'm curious why you think that Spielberg
why he fucked it up?
Was constrained. Yeah, well, he fucked it up. He was too constrained by convention or.
Well, I mean, anything I can say about why he did it is pure conjecture.
Well, but I'm saying, what about the movie?
Okay, right up until the end, I thought it was good. I was enjoying it. I'm not a big Tom Cruise fan, but we'll leave that alone for the time being. But at the end, they had him, well, all through, you know, like he was an alcoholic, he was divorced or separated, he and his wife had lost a kid, so on and so forth, and you know, that's a big load for anybody to bear, but, and I think the way they portrayed him dealing with it was very realistic and very accurate. Let me separate this out. I think the overall story and about how this predictive prevention of crime, which, by the way, Asimov dealt with in a short story before Philip K. Dick did, but that's another issue again. I think that's very compelling. I was down with that. I thought that was really good. But at the end, he showed, I can't remember the character's name, the main character, the one that Tom Cruise was playing. All of a sudden, he gets his wife back. You know, I think she's pregnant in the end, and he miraculously recovers from his alcoholism or drug addiction, you know, seemingly overnight. And, you know, it just doesn't happen that way. I mean, you can't just wake up one morning if you're a drug addict or an alcoholic and say, well, I don't think I'm going to be a drug addict anymore. And, you know, as I recall, he also was in some pretty deep shit with the law. And apparently that just went away as well. From my point of view, he caved in to the, oh, we have to have a happy ending, otherwise the audience won't like it, or we won't get enough of a crowd in here. So he, you know, he turned it around at the very end, and oh, everything, you know, just suddenly turns out peachy keen for this guy, and you know, it smacked of pandering and, like I said, wimping out.
I mean, that seems like a problem with, you know, I guess I don't, that seems like a relatively minor fault in the scheme of things for the movie. And I guess I wouldn't, I mean, there we may be talking about why, this goes back to why Hollywood in general, why movies in general suck more than they did 30 years ago. And, you know, I mean, that's a larger debate than why science fiction is suckier today than it was 30 years ago.
Well, and you know, I guess I'm not, in that particular movie, I'm not talking about the way they treated the science fiction, because I guess empirically they did that pretty well. What I'm talking about is a matter of just the way movies in general are made, and you know, the whole dramatic presentation, it's like I was just talking about with Stanley Kubrick. I mean, you look at a movie like A Clockwork Orange, and now that's not a pleasant movie, and it's not an easy movie to watch, but it's brilliant. And it's brilliant because he doesn't, like I said, he doesn't pull any punches. It's all right there in your face, and you can either take it or not. But Spielberg apparently doesn't have either the skill or the guts to do that, and the way he wimped out at the end of Minority Report is an example of that.
You know, one
Schindler's List is another issue, but go ahead, Lee. I'm sorry.
I was going to say that so many movies nowadays just have this sort of made by committee feel to them. You know, there's not a guiding intelligence leading us to the payoff.
So Lee, you're saying we need more auteurs then, right?
Yeah, well, not just that, but as we've said, like, you know, Steven Spielberg could do these things.
Sure.
But he doesn't. So
yeah.
it's not merely the, you know, even when you have people that are capable of doing it.
Of course, you could say that
forces working against them to be able or willing to do
it. You could also say that the reason he could do it is because he has never done it.
Yeah. I was going to say that part of the reason also is that Steven Spielberg is so influential that his style is so, you know, our approach to movie making is so imitated that we may not recognize that as his distinctive approach. You know, it's, we read it as Hollywood in general because what he's done has been aped so often.
I think it's a good point.
Yeah,
that he's so influential. It's not that he's imitating or giving in to anyone else. It's that everyone else is trying to copy his success.
Yeah, I mean, he's never been a movie maker like George Lucas, who you could argue with something, well, with THX 1138, or even the first Star Wars movie. I mean, there's definitely a strong argument to be made. What happened to this once promising director, right?
Well, I know what happened. He was kidnapped by a fan who replaced him with himself as a lookalike.
Yeah.
You know, real George Lucas has probably either been living in a pit for 30 years or he's dead.
You know, my take on that is that if you look at Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, which are arguably the two best of the Star Wars movies.
Given that Lucas did not direct The Empire Strikes Back.
That's right. But
still. Anyway,
and,
that's probably
or
write it. And, well, that's right. He co-wrote Star Wars and Empire. He didn't write them entirely. He didn't have complete, total creative control over them. I know his wife had a lot to do with the screenplay for Star Wars, and yes, he did direct it, but he wasn't... There were checks and balances on him in both Star Wars and Empire. And you can see in Return of the Jedi that has changed because it's still a decent movie, but it's not at the caliber of the first two. And then, of course, the prequel trilogy probably shouldn't even go there.
Yeah. So is this a good time to get out our lists? Is that does that sound good?
Yeah, that's cool for me.
Okay. Eric, why don't you give me what you've got for your, you know, your hits and misses, you know, whatever you want to call it. We're being pretty informal about that, so.
Okay, I'll start with movies, and there's one that I want to talk about in particular, but I'll just go through the list real quick. Ones that I thought were good or great were Contact, Silent Running, Forbidden Planet, Logan's Run, Star Trek the Motion Picture, Star Trek II, 2001, 2010, the original 1968 Planet of the Apes, Solaris, both the version with George Clooney and the original Russian movie, Alien, and Aliens. Ones that I thought were really awful, Mission to Mars, which starred Gary Sinise, sucked so bad it's hard to describe.
Wow, I forgot Red about that Tenet, one.
With Val Kilmer was better, but it still was not that great. The Planet of the Apes remake was execrable. There was
what?
One called the remake of Planet of the Apes.
I'm just kidding.
I'm outraged.
I'll reach through the wire and look at the phone out. There was one with Sam Neill and Lawrence Fishburne called Event Horizon. I think that was late 90s. And that one actually wasn't bad. The first two-thirds of it like were actually pretty good. And then the end just devolved into some chaotic Friday the 13th-like gore fest. And then iRobot. And, I mean, I guess taken by itself as a movie, it wasn't bad. But Asimov is maybe my favorite science fiction writer, so I really, really object to seeing his work bastardized. And that's what this movie did, too.
And you knew it was going to be, didn't you?
Well, I did, and I avoided watching. I didn't go to it in the theater. I finally broke down, and I think I Netflixed it.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to see what it was. And well, anyway, that put it on my not-so-good list.
Okay.
Do you want to do TV shows, too, or along with this, or just deal with movies right now?
Let's stick with the movies so we don't get too far off track.
So I don't have a whole lot to add to what Eric said, but the original Planet of the Apes, this has a special place in my heart, and I think for me it really combines some of the best things about great science fiction movies. And one of them is the sense of existential dread that the astronauts encounter when they wake up and they're exploring their surroundings. And I would call it dread, but I would also call it exhilaration. And at the same time, the movie also has wonderful, what you might call scenery chewing, but you could also call great passionate acting by Charlton Heston. And some really, really probing philosophical discussion that I think is worthy of the best of science fiction. So I'll just throw that
Rob,
out there.
I'm curious. Have you read Pierre Boulle's novel?
No, I haven't. I haven't.
The movie actually doesn't follow it very well. And it's you should I would recommend picking it up and reading it, but the adaptation for the original movie was so great, and one of the interesting things about that was it was the screenplay was co-written by Rod Serling, and and when you watch it, that's not so surprising because it does have kind of a feel of the Twilight Zone.
I think it definitely does.
Yeah. No, and if you it just goes back to what Lee said earlier about a sense of the vastness and of space. There's that moment where at the beginning where Charlton Heston or Taylor is alone on the ship and he says, "I feel lonely." I just think it's a wonderful way to look.
Yeah, he's talking about how the vastness of space crushes your ego and all that.
Yeah, it crushes a man's ego. So, and I also want to put in a plug for a recent movie that owes a great deal to 2001 called moon. And I think the contrasts are interesting. Not only with the role of the computer, there's a HAL-like computer on the base. I'm not going to give anything away because I don't like it. I'm not going to spoil it for you. But there are you know, similarities and differences that would be worthy of discussion in its own right.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to check that one out, Rob. It's good.
What's it called again?
It's called Moon.
Moon.
Yeah.
Lee, what do you got?
I was just stealing ideas from everyone else. I'm glad you brought up Planet of the Apes. There is a special sort of ambiance to that movie that is, you know, threatening and exciting, and I think the soundtrack plays a good role in that. Also good locations. And like other movies, I mean, Star Trek the Motion Picture has always had a spot in my heart. I remember, you know, seeing that in, I can't remember, was it the Elks? What was the big theater in Rapid?
It was that, I think the Rapid.
Oh, yeah.
I remember seeing it. It seemed like a big theater at the time.
The Rapid was the biggest screen in Rapid City, actually.
And I tell you, when that screen came up and you have the Klingon ships just gliding, you know, not racing and flying and zipping around like they're little model airplanes, but just gliding kind of out of the stars and towards this giant cloud.
Yeah.
With Goldsmith's theme behind that. That was...
Yeah.
Another movie. No, I had same composer as Planet of the Apes.
Yep.
I was taken away. So, and even though the rest of it was pretty slow in many respects, it did address, you know, you did have that sense of time and space and scale and ideas.
Yeah, at least they tried.
even though on the arc of Star Trek it was an anomaly and not really on the main path of maybe the spirit of the show. Also, yeah, like some like 2001, 2010... Solaris, you know, Alien, you know, a great, you know, probably the classic monster movie in space example. Worst, like Eric listed a lot of, I mean, there are so many, so I think I'm going to just mention two things, a TV series and a movie, that I like them, but I also am, you know, there's bad influences that came from them. The first is The Matrix, which has some really cool stuff in it, but that really doesn't make any sense.
Whoa.
You know, human, you know, this Matrix existing for the sake of making human beings into batteries is not sense. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. You know, it would have been fun to come up with a better explanation for the Matrix than that.
Lee, can I interrupt you for just a second?
Yes,
how do you think that particular explanation or whatever compares to the way a somewhat similar idea was handled in Dark City, which is a movie I like quite a bit?
Oh yeah, I'd say that's yeah. Dark City was much better.
At least, especially on
that
part.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, that just reminded me of that. It's like, this is one where they got that part at least more right.
Yeah. You're right. It's a very similar sort of story. It's like, where are we? What are we? And the sort of revelation at the end.
Right.
You know, with a lot less kung fu action and machine gunning.
Exactly.
Everybody in sight. The other thing I was going to talk about really quickly, even though I at the time I really enjoyed Star Trek The Next Generation, but I think it really exacerbated some serious problems that have served to undermine this more serious conception of science fiction, which is just all the kind of the gizmos and all the shortcuts and all the... all these things that basically are not science, they're just a form of magic, in a sense, and that this undermines, you know, it just makes it, it's just so easy to turn to these sorts of things to create plots and resolve plots.
Well,
and,
you know,
and it actually it begins, you know, mostly innocently in the original Star Trek, where you have, you know, you have warp speed, and you have teleporters, and or transporters, and which are, you know, I think reasonable concessions because you need to get around, and you don't want to be taking the shuttle down every single time you go visit a planet, you know. But it seems like this expands, and it's not a problem that it happens within a single series, but then that sort of easy, you know, these sort of shortcuts, instead of actually trying to think through things in a more realistic, science-friendly manner, you know, that helped undermine this other kind of science fiction.
Yeah, and Lee, I would agree with that. Somewhere along the way, I mean, for all its camp and all of its flaws, the thing that I love about original Star Trek is that it almost always was about ideas. It, you know, right. And maybe they weren't presented as coherently or as elegantly as they could have been, but still, at the core, it was almost always was about some thoughtful, interesting idea. And a lot of Next Gen actually was that way too, but especially as the Next Gen movie series moved along, the last two were pathetic. You know, I don't know, it ceased to be about, after First Contact, I think it pretty much ceased to be about ideas, and you're right, it just feeds into that false idea about what science fiction is or should be that seems to be pervasive.
I mean, like, and one example might be, like, with the most recent Star Trek movie, I mean, they have a supernova in it. I can't remember if we actually see it, but somehow it's a supernova that can somehow destroy the galaxy, which I'm not quite clear on. But what about a movie or a TV show that actually centered more on a real supernova and what real supernovas do? There's no reason why you can't do that, but it's easier to just use some of these scientific sounding things as just a plot point to advance, you know, the action.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, I guess the Star Trek The Next Generation really made a serious attempt to engage with science. And it did some of the, especially the early episodes are boring because really getting into the science of the topic that they're, you know, of the episode, but there's very little interesting character conflict or character development.
Right.
And I think that was a problem with Star Trek The Next Generation, that it did make a serious attempt. I think really that watching that, especially the first couple seasons, watching it again kind of comes across as a little bit endearing, you know, that they actually were, you know, you'd never get away with it now on a TV show, being as boring as they were. Anyway,
and Rob, it's been so long since I've seen, especially the early stuff. In fact, I probably haven't seen an actual Next Generation show for quite 10 years. So I'm going from memory. And also, but what I'm saying is not necessarily conflicting with what you're saying, because I just think that those elements that I'm talking about are the ones that have sort of metastasized and
what
had more of an influence than the boring stuff, which I would like to see more of, because the boring stuff is usually the most interesting stuff.
You know, it's interesting because as we're talking about this, I keep coming back to Star Trek II, and the more I think about it, the more that is not only the best example of not only a Star Trek movie, but a Star Trek story, it also is an excellent example of what Hollywood science fiction can be if it's thoughtfully done and written and produced, because you have a combination of, you know, wonderful dramatic conflict between characters and you know, really compelling character development too. And you get some really cool outer space battles between the ships, but you also have a very highbrow science fiction concept in the Genesis device, you know, a device that can be used very constructively to take lifeless worlds and turn them into habitable planets for colonization. Or, you know, obviously in the wrong hands, it can also be used as a, you know, horrific weapon, which, you know, bring it, it's to begin with a really interesting science concept, you know, the ability, you know, what would it take to actually be able to terraform an entire planet? And, but then you also have the moral, ethical, sociopolitical question of, you know, is this, should we do this? Is it a wise use of power? What do we do to keep it from being used destructively? Yep. So, I mean, and it blends those elements seamlessly.
Yeah, no, it's wonderful. And yeah, Genesis is a great character in a sense. I mean, it's a presence. It's kind of the unspoken thing that, or often spoken, I guess, but that's what it's revolving around in a way, is this of who's going to control it and how it's going to be used.
It's definitely easy enough to name that one the best. It doesn't quite have it does have some good science fiction in it as well, just beyond the fact that it's such a great story.
Yeah.
And all that. Have you guys mentioned another one that's a couple of movies that have come up that I hadn't seen in a while but think of as being at least have some really good in the ideas department? One of them is The Day the Earth Stood Still. And also the original version of the Andromeda Strain.
Oh, yes. And actually, those are two excellent examples.
Both Robert Wise, obviously, too. But the Day the Earth Stood Still is such a great... great idea, and the of course the Cold War and politics of it are really fun to look at as well. And Andromeda Strain, obviously, you know, has lots of science in it and really, really interesting ideas as well.
Well, the thing that really intrigues me about the Andromeda Strain is that you would think that it would be unbearably boring, but Wise actually manages to make it very dramatic and even riveting. And to this day, I remember the first time I saw it. I was quite young, and I couldn't sleep that night because that the ending of it was so eerie and menacing that I couldn't get it out of my head. Every now and then I have to haul that out and watch it because it's a really compelling story. I've always enjoyed it,
and I always like the fact that things are potentially completely undone by a printer jam.
Yeah,
if you remember that.
Yeah,
like on some old teletype like machine or dot matrix thing, and the little piece of paper gets jammed in there, and that almost is the ruin of everybody.
Yeah,
that's too much reality. That's the way it's really going to happen, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's almost back to the old fail-safe, common things being screwed up that can bring the end of the world, that kind of thing.
There's another movie that I'd like to get your opinion on, and that's Contact, the one with Jodie Foster.
Oh yes. I personally enjoy Contact. I think it's a fun idea, and I have a certain fondness for it. Actually, I think it's neat. Maybe the ending is a little bit too sappy or something. I don't know, but I liked it a lot actually. Although I can't stand Matthew McConaughey. That's the one problem I have with it.
Yeah, I'm not a big Matthew McConaughey fan myself, but the the whole sense of wonder, sense of time and space that we've talked about, I think it captures that and evokes it very, very well. I think it's just a compelling story, and, you know, in terms of the science, it's one of those few that really pays some attention, doesn't give short shrift to the science. There's nothing that's completely ridiculous or implausible about it.
You know, it's been so long since I've seen it, but I think I was a little put off by the ending as being overly sentimental, as though aliens existed for our psychological, you know, therapeutic purposes. And I also thought in Matthew McConaughey's character, there's a little bit of glossing over the sort of potential conflict between religion and science.
And I actually would maybe place some, you know, this is Robert Zemeckis who did this, so, you know, he's not exactly one to dive into confrontational issues too much.
Thinker. Oh, okay, yeah, not.
Well, yeah, director of Forrest Gump, after all.
I'm never going to get a job in Hollywood, by the way. This podcast is going to alienate.
You know, I was just going to say about, it's been also a long time since I've seen the movie, but I remember from when I saw it being very disappointed in the Matthew McConaughey character, that, you know, he's kind of there to represent the intuitive, religious, spiritual,
in a very condescending, annoying way, too.
Semi-hippie dimension. Yeah, I mean, just in a very simplistic, uninteresting, cliche-ridden way. Which I don't know. I mean,
well, it's easy to not take him at all. I find it easy not to take him seriously, because of the way it's written.
Yeah. That I think that, you know, it would have been a much more interesting movie to have him be a much more robust, interesting. Have a much more robust and interesting and complex view, instead of, like I say, just it being this sort of. He came across to me as this kind of a this hippie like character, I guess, and.
Well, you know,
which is not a good foil for the scientific perspective.
Well, actually, you know, it's interesting because I don't see that character as representing mainstream or even radical religion. I see that character as being the mediator between science and the radical religious types. Because if you go back and rewatch the movie. There is a very distinct, very vocal element of, you know, the fundamentalists, the far right-wing...
Right, the ones who are out protesting and that kind of
right,
stuff.
Right, right.
And they blow up the first device, right?
Right.
Right. And McConaughey's character, I think, is more of a mediator between those two because he doesn't... he's much more of a very liberal... I guess he's actually an ordained minister, but he isn't. The impression is that he's not practicing. He's more off on his own, doing his own thing. And
he
that
smokes pot. Or am I project? Am I just inserting that, or is that something that I can't remember?
No.
Well, I know Matthew McConaughey does.
No, those aren't his pupils. Those are just contacts. Yeah. But like I'm saying, I see him as not being the type with, you know, the feeble, literal interpretation of the Bible, being able to say, okay, you know, this is the way, you know, they describe or understood and described the universe 3,000 years ago. This is science explaining how it actually works. Being able to see both sides of the issue, if you will. But,
yeah, I mean, yeah. That's the role I think he should have played. But just it's been a long time since I've seen it. But my recollection is that he was very, you know, that position he was supposed to take, he took in a very sort of flaccid, uninteresting sort of way.
It does, you know, the movie does
have
the character,
not him himself, is not necessarily the big problem.
The movie does have an amazing opening. Where the you know, the endless pull away from the Earth if you guys remember that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of that particular little piece there.
Yeah, that works really well.
Yeah.
Even though, sadly, I think, I don't know if this is true, I thought I was reading this or heard this a few days ago or a while back that even maybe some people with SETI actually determined or suspected that radio waves actually break down pretty quickly after leaving the Earth. So our signals may not actually be traveling out into the depths of space to be received by anybody. And there may not be any signals, you know, maybe that's why we've never picked up signals, is that, you know, just the cosmic interference from all the stuff that's out there basically breaks up these waves to the point where they become incoherent fairly swiftly. So I don't know if this is, I don't know if any of you have heard about this, but I thought I heard or read something about that. Well, if so, that's pretty sad for
yeah, it is,
for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, because that's really the way that we would best way to learn about it.
Yeah,
and all those people running that program on their computers, trying to it's all.
Yeah, I remember doing that for a while.
Yeah, I used to do it too.
But I suspected it was a scam.
Arr.
Well, I'm okay that we're not contacting aliens, because, you know, after thinking about 2001 again, you know, the aliens, the monolith comes and teaches us to kill and have warfare, and so they're not necessarily going to be, you know, gee, they might do what we do, which is act in our own interests. And other species and other, you know, countries or whoever are distant second.
Do any of you have any television shows that we haven't talked about that you want to bring up? Or?
I've got some if you want to. I can just name them off. We've talked about Battlestar Galactica, the remake primarily, but there's also the original 1975 version, which...
Which does have its glorious moments.
Okay.
it does. I'm serious.
Great hair.
Would you care to name one?
The hair?
Boxy...
Well, the first shot of the Cylon, the wave of Cylon raiders during the pilot.
Okay.
And the Cylons themselves.
That is chilling.
And the Cylons themselves, I think, look pretty cool. That's a pretty cool design.
Sure. Until you see the three of them trying to fly a ship.
Yeah, then you're...
it breaks down.
You're a lot less impressed. You know, and also the spaceships are cool. The fighters are extremely cool. I mean, they keep the basic design of the Viper for the new show.
Yeah.
You know, and the Base Stars are really cool. The Battlestar design is awesome.
Yep.
Even if it is vaguely phallic, but that's okay.
Well, what science fiction ships aren't?
Well, that's true.
Look at 2001.
Yeah, there you go. We talked about Stargate and Babylon 5. Do you remember the original that, you know, I think that was, it was either late 70s or very early 80s, they had a Buck Rogers series on?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
That was magnificent.
Okay,
that was
Rob.
A classic of the era. There was Twiggy. That character.
Bitty.
Dr. Theopolis.
What's up, Buck?
Oh, yeah.
Dr. Theopolis.
I remember, Rob, you going on about that.
Dr. God City.
Yeah. What is that? What's that about? Stupid name.
Well, we also have the various incarnations of Trek, three incarnations of the Twilight Zone, 1960s, 1980s, and then there was, they tried to revive it in around 2000, 2001. There were some others along the way. Lost in Space was contemporary with Star Trek, and actually, you know, that was kind of a shame what happened with that, because it started off and it was a reasonably serious, high-minded show, and then it pretty quickly devolved into ridiculous camp. But and I don't know why that happened, but interestingly enough, CBS, Roddenberry pitched Star Trek to CBS before he pitched it to NBC, and they said, no, we've got our own. It's called Lost in Space. Let's see. There was also a couple of other 60s that I vaguely recall. One was Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea,
And that was about a super advanced submarine that could go really, really deep. No innuendo there. One called The Invaders, and I just vaguely remember that. It was something about alien invasion.
Eric, how about The Outer Limits?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
That one was kind of a hybrid show. It was science fiction and monster thriller stuff and political stories, and, you know, it was really an odd show, actually.
Yeah, they had some good stuff, though, I remember.
Well, Harlan Ellison wrote two of them.
Yeah, Shatner was in at least one of them.
Yeah, very, very amusing episode.
Yeah. There was one called Sequest DSV, which was actually kind of like Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
And no one has brought up Doctor Who.
I was going to get to that.
Okay. now, we could do a whole show on Doctor Who, but...
Actually, three that I remember, and we don't have to dwell on them very much. One is Space 1999, which was a British show. It was originally by same guy who did Thunderbirds and... oh, I'm trying to remember the name now. Him and his wife... did the first season of it, and I remember when it was like 1975, and it was 75 to 77, and it was Jerry and Sylvia Anderson, yeah. And I remember the first season was the science wasn't done very well, but there were some interesting ideas there, and it was, you know, it was at least thoughtfully done. Then the second season, what's his name? Freiberg. It was a guy who stepped in to produce the third season of original Trek and fucked it up in a lot of ways. I'm trying to remember his name. I think it was Freiberg.
Any parting shots?
You want to say anything quickly about Doctor Who? Or
I think it's probably best that we leave that to, you know, another another session, because there's a lot we could get into. Thanks, everybody, and thanks for listening, if anybody has been. And we'll see you all next time. Good night.
Night.
Bye. Bye.